This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Ahval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me this morning is Justin Bronk. He is a research fellow for Air Power at the Royal United Services Institute in London. Justin, welcome to Turkey Abroad.
Thanks for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
The topic of today is going to be on Turkey's fifth generation fighter program, the TFX. And I wanted to get your take on a few questions with it, since it's had something of a checkered history since it was first announced in 2013 as a potential replacement for Turkey's current fleet of F-16 jets. And the initial launch date for these jets, the TFX at least, was going to be in 2023, which is 2 years away. But now the first flight is not even scheduled until 2025, and the jet may not come into service until 2029. Why is it, Justin, that Turkey has really seemed to struggle to get this whole endeavor off the ground? No pun intended.
I think there's a couple of kind of factors that feed into the reasons why this is really quite a difficult task that Turkey has set itself. The first one being simply that because while Turkey's been very successful in developing an indigenous remotely piloted UAV industry pretty much from scratch, using expertise gained from leasing Israeli drones for a while, there seems to be among certain aspects of the political commentariat an expectation that therefore Turkey can spin up a combat aircraft, as in a fast jet manufacturing base, in a similar way. And so the first factor I'd kind of highlight is just that while the Bayraktar and Anka programs have shown that the top-down prioritized investment model is viable in Turkey, the air vehicles themselves are actually very simple by comparison to even a fourth generation fast jet. The level of complexity that you're dealing with in terms of the systems, the propulsion, the cooling, the manufacturing tolerances, and the sensor integration that you have to do for even a fourth generation fast jet is really a huge leap for any nation that hasn't kind of done that before indigenously. We've seen with India that has a long history through HAL of manufacturing under license, both trainers and fourth generation jets, and also has proven extremely good at modernizing, often with indigenous or kind of multi-source components, fast jets. They've still struggled greatly with their relatively low ambition Tejas program. It's taken them a lot longer than they wanted it to. It's cost a lot more than it should have done. And the problems that they've had in the Mark 1 and to an extent Mark 1A with quality control and with manufacturing tolerances are an illustration of just how difficult this is. Given that Turkey is trying to start in the deep end, as it were, with a kind of fifth generation, quote unquote, jet, they really have bitten off a huge chunk of a task here. When you look at the other factors on sort of fifth generation jets specifically, there's two areas of key challenge. The most obvious one is the stealth, so that the very low observability, which is certainly a challenge, although there are sufficient both prototypes and operational fifth generation aircraft now around the world that Turkey probably has a fair bit to go on in terms of the sort of rough shapes that work. And it's no surprise with some of the TFX models and the, similarly with the Korean KFX. They kind of resemble an F-22 to a fairly strong degree, with kind of mixed elements of F-35 and other bits and bobs thrown in, because, you start with what works and then you move from there. The problem is that while it's relatively easy to produce something that looks a bit like a stealth aircraft, it's very, very difficult to produce something that has the requisite manufacturing tolerances, particularly around things as like joints, hinges, air vents, and of course, sensor positions, where you can do all of those things, which a combat aircraft moving surfaces and control surfaces and sensors have to do without compromising the radar signature. That's an enormously difficult challenge to master from scratch. And then another one again, to be able to do it on more than a couple of prototypes, i.e. to be able to push it through to mass production. And the second less obvious challenge, but which is arguably more difficult still, is a fifth generation jet like the F-22 or the F-35 has two aspects to its kind of lethality and survivability. One is the stealth, but the second one is being able to build up a situational awareness picture of the battle space around it without giving itself away with its own sensor emissions. So that means, in practice, an active electronically scanned array or AESA type radar, which is the most advanced type of fighter radar currently out there, which only a few countries have shown they can manufacture. But not just an AESA, one which has sufficient programming complexity and kind of capability to be able to do what's called LPI, LPD, or low probability of intercept, low probability of detection scanning. In other words, it can scan as a normal radar does, but in a way that makes it very difficult to tell from an opponent's perspective that they are being scanned. That is absolutely critical for a fifth generation fighter. It's no use developing an airframe that is stealthy and putting traditional radar on it, because then when it starts to scan for targets, it will give itself away to anyone with modern passive sensors, which is pretty much every opponent that you might worry about. So given Turkey's approaching all of this from scratch, they've really set themselves an incredibly difficult target here. And that's not to say anything of things like the need to, because you can't have, the surface has to be smooth and without blemishes. If you have issues around cooling, for example, temperature regulation, you can't just do what you do in a fourth generation jet or earlier and put another vent in, another air intake, because that would ruin the signature. You basically have to have a very, very capable team who can do internal temperature control and sort of regulation within the surface of the aircraft. And that means that you have to start looking at how you're going to do all the advanced sensors that you need and all the advanced systems that you need while you're still looking at the basic airframe design, because it all has to be integrated. And this is why, again, Russia and China have found Russia more than China. But that, once they've managed to get things that look a bit like a fifth gen fighter, it's a hugely long road to getting something into production.
As you mentioned, it does become abundantly clear that Turkey is undertaking this really large and complicated endeavor by jumping straight into the deep end. And one of the problems that I noticed in my reading about the TFX program is that it also comes down to the issue of technology transfer. And of course, maybe to a lot of the listeners, they'll think about, when they hear about Turkey's problems with technology transfer, they'll think about the whole debacle related to getting the Patriot from the US, but then ultimately ending up with the Russian S-400 over technology transfer. And one problem that I saw was that Turkey's also struggled to get a hold of a proper jet to get the program going. And one official told Defense News that without the engine, it grinds almost the whole program to a halt. I saw that Turkey had previously had negotiations with BAE Systems in the UK on trying to acquire an engine, but it didn't really seem to go anywhere but a wall, to my understanding right now. But can you explain why Turkey is struggled so much in this area of technology transfer when it comes to the engine, or why it's consistently being unable to produce its own, whether it on the technology on that front?
Yeah, so again, engines is a whole area in and of itself, but essentially there are currently three manufacturers in the world that have proven an ability to manufacture consistently at the required quality really high-end fighter aircraft engines, and that is Pratt & Whitney, General Electric, and Rolls-Royce. You then have a kind of second tier of manufacturers who can manufacture viable combat aircraft engines, but they don't develop the same levels of thrust potential. They don't have quite the same levels of reliability, or at least they're having to operate close enough to the design thrust potential of the engine, i.e. to the maximum thrust that it can produce, that they can't get the extra reliability that the really sort of top tier engines get by operating in what's called derated configuration. So if you look at something like the EJ200, the Eurojet 200 that powers the Eurofighter or the Typhoon, or the the General Electric series of engines that power a lot of American aircraft, most of them operate derated. They put out about 10 to 15% less power than they theoretically can. Now, this both helps them give a constant amount of power, even in, for example, hot and high conditions where jet thrust drops relative to cold and low sea level. But it also means that the engine's just under a lot less strain because it's not having to be operated as close to the maximum kind of design tolerances. So that sort of second tier would encompass probably Snecma, who make the M88 that powers the Rafale. The Rafale, magnificent combat aircraft, but the M88's always been the sort of comparative weak point. It's a bit underpowered, particularly above 50,000 feet compared to something like Typhoon or F-15. And the Russian Saturn series, so the AL-31 and 41F, as well as their Saturn 30, I believe it's called, or is Izdilye 30, which is supposed to power their Sukhoi 57, but which isn't ready and hasn't been ready for a long time. The problem for the Russians is essentially one of quality control and metallurgy. So they struggle in fighter-sized engines to get to the temperature that would give you the sort of levels of efficiency in terms of thrust output to size and fuel consumption that you see in the top Western engines. You see, for example, the engines that power their Tu-22s, the Tu-22M3, you do get really high temperature burning, but that's a much bigger turbofan. Then in the third tier, you've basically got the Chinese, who are catching up to the Russians, but still struggling basically to get the quality control down. So there's a big difference, and Turkey will have looked at all of these examples quite closely when trying to work out what approach to take. There's a huge difference between knowing, even if you know what the sort of alloys and manufacturing techniques are for a really high performance jet turbine, it's very difficult to actually, particularly if you're starting from scratch, to get to the stage where you are consistently able to meet those requirements. So the Chinese, for example, know well enough what they have to do, but they're still struggling, particularly with factories spread out in different areas, to do things like completely eliminate environmental contamination, get all of the different impurity levels down to the low levels they need to be. And so only slowly over time are you seeing things like the WS-10 series get to a level of reliability where they're comfortable putting them on single-engined aircraft. And the WS-15, which is supposed to power the J-20 as the definitive engine, is still nowhere near ready. So again, Turkey starting from scratch, it's an enormously difficult thing to set up. And given that it's still a NATO member and it still has good links with the Russians, which is an issue from the NATO member perspective, but with the Americans and some European countries, it would seem the obvious route for reducing risk and cost in the TFX program to go with a proven engine from somebody else. The difficulty is, because there's so few people who know how to do this stuff well, the idea that you're going to get a license to manufacture the engines in Turkey with the IP transfer is probably pushing it. There's very little reason for Rolls-Royce, GE or Pratt & Whitney to agree to that level of tech transfer because there's nobody else in the world who can do it that well. Frankly, I think with the levels of ambition we've seen around some of the TFX prototypes in terms of models and things, I think you'd probably get away with using an F-135, so the F-35 derivative, if you were going for some sort of single engine solution, so a 40,000 pound class, or a derivative of either the EJ200 or one of the General Electric or Pratt & Whitney series that power the F-15. Because if Turkey was looking at going for something heavier that needed really more thrust than that in the kind of class of the F-22, which obviously does have more thrust, then the cost per flying hour and the cost per airframe is probably going to become prohibitive anyway. I think they need to go for something a bit smaller.
Mm-hmm. When Turkey announced the TFX program back in 2013, that was at a time when they were still involved with the development of the F-35, which of course they no longer are after acquiring the S-400 from Russia back in 2019. Afterwards, of course, back in December, the U.S. finally sanctioned Turkey for that purchase. And some of those included export restrictions for goods going to Turkey's defense sector, the SSB. I want to ask you, how are U.S. sanctions in any way against Turkey through CATSA impacting the TFX program?
Well, it will have an enormous impact in terms of what Turkey can leverage in terms of tech brought in from the U.S. A lot of European competitor programs still have some ITAR component containing sort of components. So a lot of components that are covered by ITAR stuff. So I think comparatively speaking, it will make both Russian for things other than the engines and European partners more attractive than the Americans. But there will still be potential stumbling blocks. It is worth remembering that, while Turkey has swung more to the Russian side of the sort of Russia-West balance that it's traditionally tried to leverage both sides of, there is the potential for it to swing back the other way. And there's certainly an appetite in the rest of NATO to see Turkey, get closer again to the rest of the alliance, because it is a huge strategic problem for Turkey to be drifting away in quite such a dramatic fashion. On the other hand, there's no way around the fact that ownership of an S-400 system with Russian technicians around is just a straight prohibition on using any of the highest end Western combat air systems, because S-400 is one of the key threat systems for NATO on the eastern flank. So, I think there are still perhaps some parties within Turkey that believes there's a deal to be done there. I really don't think there is. Mm. That for once, the West really did mean what it said there. That was an either or decision. So if Turkey were at some point to give up that system, well, then I expect you'd find quite a warm reception in the rest of NATO for a kind of return to the fold, as it were. But for now, it's a pretty inconvenient barrier to improving relations.
Well, speaking of inconvenient, the other option that has come up recently has been the idea that Russia could ultimately make up in some way for the loss of the F-35. When Erdogan visited Putin a couple of years ago, it was at the Max Air Show where they were talking about purchases potentially even of the SU-35 or the SU-57. And Russian export officials have consistently said that they're just waiting on Turkey to say that they're interested in it. And I also saw that Russia had mentioned that it would be interested, if asked again, to help with the TFX program and getting it along. And even though Turkey's already been sanctioned for the S-400, Russia the Russians are having a very difficult time with their own fifth generation fighter program as well. So what I want to ask you is, are the SU-35 and the SU-57 even feasible replacements for Turkey at this point with the F-35? And how much of a possible alternative is Russia really for Turkey at this point, considering they're already under sanctions for the S-400?
Yeah. Well, the first thing to say is that the Sukhoi 57 at this point is, I would not say, a true, it's not even very low observable, let alone a true kind of comparable fifth generation aircraft to something like the F-35 or the F-22. It just doesn't have the signature reduction features at a refined enough level to allow it to meaningfully depend on not being detected by modern sensors to operate in that way. Even with weapons internal, for example, design choices around the leading edge route extension control surfaces, the movable control surfaces, adds hinges complexity and moving parts at precisely the point where you don't want them. That there isn't really room to do full-scale S-bends to hide the turbine faces. So they've had to go for kind of grills to try and achieve the same effect, but they're not as effective. And there's things like the ram air intakes at the base of the vertical, well, the canted stabilizers, which again are not good, nor is the circular IRST in front of the canopy. So yeah, it's got to be remembered also that the F-22 and the F-35, which are much, much stealthier, particularly the F-22, are still having to, you know, continue to adapt tactics, be upgraded in order to try and stay ahead of the threat, because sensor technology is so much more advanced than it was when those platforms were designed. So, you know, to be a replacement for the F-35 from Russia's perspective as a manufacturer, they not only have to be as stealthy as the F-22 or F-35 were when they were designed, but they actually have to be more stealthy because A, Western sensor technology is generally better in terms of the resolution that it operates at. So if the threat you're looking at is something like a modernized APG-81 AESA radar on an F-35, or, you know, the equivalent on an F-22, or the big Captor E that's coming for Typhoon, or the Rafales, I forget the exact term, but the Rafales AESA, you're having to operate at a level of stealth beyond what the F-35 operates at to kind of future-proof in any way at VLO in the sort of timeframes that Turkey's looking at for TFX. So yeah, I don't think Russia is at all viable as a potential replacement. What the Su-57 does represent is a way of solving for the Russian Air Force and potentially for customers as well. So it should be the Russian Aerospace Forces, yeah, get the terminology right. It represents a way of solving a lot of the core downsides of the Flanker series. So with the Su-35 as the kind of current top-end example, the problem for the Flanker series is they don't have AESA radars, so they're limited to non-LPI, LPD type scanning. And they have an enormous radar and visual and infrared cross-section. So they're very easy to detect both actively and passively at long ranges. And they just don't have the missiles to outrange things, even if they can detect them themselves. So they're basically just outranged in almost any scenario against a NATO equivalent. While they remain extremely dangerous within visual range, but that's a limited part of the mission set. What the Su-57 gives you is finally a flanker derivative, which is kind of what it is, which has a markedly lower radar cross-section, which does have an AESA radar, in fact, several, although they're not working properly yet, but, you know, assuming they get there, suddenly you and carries the missiles internally. So suddenly you have something which is competing with the best advanced fourth generation aircraft in terms of detectability, and, you know, also potentially with upgraded R-77 derivatives, or, you know, it can't carry the R-37 internally, but at least it's going to be competitive with the kind of the best advanced fourth generation types. And in that sense, does it offer Turkey a potentially viable replacement for part of its F-16 fleet several years down the line, assuming that Turkey wishes to pay the price in terms of further disengagement from NATO and potentially even being kicked out? Yes. Does it offer a replacement for what the F-35 gives you, which is the ability to operate inside highly defended airspace? No.
What about other alternatives at this point then to the TFX? I saw that you wrote a commentary recently on Russia about how when the U.S. Air Force chief had mentioned they might consider pursuing a cheaper platform than the F-35 or even seeking out an expanded fleet of lower cost combat drones is again a more cost effective option, and Turkey's obviously shown its teeth as a drone country, and of course like a TB2 Bayraktar costs a fraction of the estimated $100 million per plane that the TFX is projected to ultimately cost. Is it in your view a possibility that Turkey or even other nations could forego developing fifth generation fighters in favor of cheaper platforms like combat drones?
The problem with going with unpiloted is so what Turkey has shown it can do is remotely piloted. So dependent on line of sight, radio-based VHF control links. In future, they might try and go for what the Americans and to an extent the Chinese and Russians do, which is rely on satellite links to allow beyond line of sight operations for in terms of command relay. The problem is Turkey doesn't have the orbital infrastructure to support that. So, you know, they'd have to probably contract that from another power. But in any case, remotely piloted basically isn't viable against a modern peer opponent because the data links or SATCOM links are just too obvious, i.e. they can be detected, which gives away the platform itself, even if the platform is relatively stealthy or very stealthy. That data link gives it away. That command link gives it away. We saw this with the Americans losing an RQ-170 Sentinel, which is an extremely stealthy flying wing spy drone, but which was remotely flown with a SATCOM link, presumably. They lost one to Iran in 2011. Now, Iran, particularly in 2011, is not a peer competitor. It's a sub-peer, or you know, maybe a near-peer if you're being charitable. They had no radars capable of showing that UAV was there in terms of detecting the aircraft itself. But they were not only able to detect the command link, they were actually able to override it and land the thing while preventing it from self-destructing. So essentially, it's just not viable to rely on remotely piloted if you want your unmanned for peer conflicts against states, for kind of lower level stuff, as the Bayraktars have shown, as the US has shown repeatedly with Reaper, that's absolutely fine. But it's basically for permissive or at best semi-permissive airspace. The alternative approach is to go for high levels of in-flight autonomy, where you have a human programming in a mission set and the rules of engagement before flight, and an ability to monitor the system and give updated directions as and when you can ensure connectivity, but where basically the system can operate on its own as it needs to, particularly if connectivity is denied or would give it away. With that, though, you're very limited in terms of the mission sets that you can do with that, even if you accept the levels of lethal autonomy that implies. You can certainly do that for suppression of enemy air defenses, because basically civilians don't use surface-to-air missile fire control radars. So, you know, the signature targeting on that is pretty easy. As a kind of programming and ethics task. Loitering munitions already do this, so there's precedent. You could potentially do it for offensive counter-air, but only really in a scenario where you're satisfied that there's nothing civilian flying around and nothing non-aligned flying around, because you probably can't trust the automation to purely signature targets in that environment. Although, it must be said that if something is flying at supersonic speeds beyond a kind of demarcated shoot down line or you know, transonic speeds, and it is radiating a fire control radar, again, you can probably be fairly sure that it's military. But if you're looking for the sort of things that combat aircraft are routinely tasked to do, particularly in the Middle East, i.e. operations against targets where combatancy is often a subjective judgment made according to the sensor picture at the time, or encounters along disputed airspace borders where aircraft are intercepting each other and shadowing each other, perhaps signaling, you know, flashing weapons, flashing flares, maybe even doing relatively unsafe passes on each other to signal intent, it's almost impossible to get an AI-driven system, even with fairly advanced AI, that can operate like that. And as we've seen repeatedly in the Middle East, even if you did, the odds are that an opponent would just shoot your UAV down because it doesn't involve the escalation risk of killing a pilot. So for most of the tasks you need fighter aircraft for, UCAVs, as they would be, so unmanned combat aerial vehicles, i.e. designed for lethality and survivability rather than remotely piloted UAVs, they're suitable for offensive aerial tasks, but they're not really suited for replacing your fighter force at this stage, and are unlikely to be so for some time.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one last question I'd also like to ask you, and it's that Turkey's still a NATO country, of course, and it is announced that it would be upgrading its F-16 fleet in the meantime until the TFX program can come online. Right now, the economy is sluggish. It's weakening from a whole variety of factors. And this quest for independence for its military industrial sector has been stalled by that, on top of the inability to get the technical know-how to advance further. What kind of risk do you see over the horizon for Turkey or NATO more broadly if its Air Force does not acquire a new jet soon enough?
Well, the big question there is, A, how likely is it that you have a major conflict? Because, you know, Turkey can probably run on its F-16s for a long time. It will consistently lose access to the most modern upgrades, and it will struggle with certain spares and survivability and maintenance sort of contracts if the current rate of tension with the US is maintained. Ultimately, that is a Turkish decision. It's the US, you know, even when there was a more, should we say, transactional rather than principle-led president in the last administration, he was still very much bound by Congress. And the DOD has its own recommendations. So I think, unfortunately, for you know, Erdogan himself, the ball is very much in his court there. If he pursues consistent increasing ties with the Russians, I think there will be a strong move in NATO to firewall Turkey out of a lot of things, and that will increase over time. If Turkey eventually ends up either de facto or in or officially a sort of partial or even non-member state, then its sovereign defense needs are going to rise, because it doesn't have that, you know, Article 5 guarantee of its security, and ultimately it sits in a very contested part of the world at a strategic crossroads, sandwiched between various powers. So I think a key determinant of what challenges Turkey will face if it can't find an affordable route to rapidly replace its F-16s in the later 2020s will depend on whether that political choice is made to continue along the current course, in which case there'll probably be a lot of challenges and they'll have to buy suboptimal stuff, probably from the Russians, maybe even the Chinese, who incidentally, I'd say the Chinese are the more competitive export prospect at this point. You know, Turkey could do a lot worse than J-10C if it wanted a cheap and cheerful multi-role, relatively capable modern replacement for F-16 and couldn't get it from the West. You know, you'd be mad to look at Russia when the J-10C is on offer. But anyway, all of which is to say that the flip side is also true. You know, if there is a change of heart on particularly the S-400 and the kind of closeness of relations with Russia in general, and Turkey moves back towards a closer relationship with NATO, I think, A, the F-16 modernization and maintainability question will become a heck of a lot easier. But also, you'd probably find that a lot of the key channels for tech transfer, or at least high-level cooperation on sensitive issues around engines and sensors, which will be crucial to making TFX work, will become a lot easier. So, yeah, it's a typical think tanker answer. It depends on the political direction.
Well, that's sort of just the situation as it is, basically, where it ultimately comes down to, will Turkey do or what will Turkey not do, basically. And I think that's just been the big question on everyone's mind, think tanks, journalists, etc., for a long time now. It's just a matter of choice on the Turkish end, and those choices continue to surprise us.
It is worth remembering that that France and Britain, which both have a long history of indigenous and cooperative combat aircraft development over many generations, and in the UK's case has worked extremely closely on the F-35 program, have both concluded that they cannot afford independently to develop their own next generation combat aircraft. So given they already have the infrastructure required and a lot more of the technology and a lot more of the know-how in terms of exposure, and particularly in the UK's case, that cost point would be one I'd seriously stress on Turkey. To put it in perspective, the UK contributions just to the research and development and then the acquisition on Typhoon in real terms today was about £34 billion. And that was as one member of a four strong consortium that was sharing a lot of the costs of development. Now, yes, that consortium cost did make it overall a more expensive platform because you had to take into account four different countries' requirements and four different production lines and all of that. But, you know, the UK still paid £34 billion, and that's not even starting on the operating costs, on the training, on the munitions, on all the other stuff that you have to do afterwards once you've bought the things. So if you assume Turkey can build a more capable, because it'll be, you know, fifth gen, or at least that's what they're trying to do, a more capable product than Typhoon from scratch, with no experience as an industry, as an industrial sort of sector in the country of doing this themselves, for no more than the UK spent on its quarter share of Typhoon in real terms, they still have to find £34-35 billion. So what, $55 billion?
Mm-hmm.
That's a big ask.
Yeah, and the massive, this is a massive shadow that really the whole TFX program is casting over the situation. As you said, and I will continue to quote from the beginning of this conversation, it bit off a lot more than it could potentially chew, but we're going to end up seeing more developments with this program down the line. Hopefully soon to, at that point, have you back on the show if you are available. And then we can go once again into talking about, you know, where we stand on the whole fifth generation fighter conundrum for Turkey and NATO as well.
Sounds good.
Justin, it was great to have you, but we've reached the end of the program. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to hearing from you again.
My pleasure. Good luck with stuff.
Thank you very much. My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.